This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer. It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Fantastic to have you with us for another episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. We were talking tantrums. Many parents experiencing a bit of a tough time with their little ones at the moment. So bringing in the big guns, Principal Lisa was on hand to take on your questions, explaining what happens during the brain during a tantrum and why it's simply not a good time to try and apply logic. And in light of a tragic accident in the UK recently, choking hazards around the home. We were in conversation with Rebecca from Safe Hands, teaching us what to do in that moment. And Dr. Rania, paediatrician, was live on the line for a free clinic around your child's health. Plus, IB exam results out this week. What happens if your child hasn't achieved the grades they wanted or he's even exceeded them? We had education expert Fiona McKenzie on hand to explain the options. Good luck to everyone out there.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking tantrums. Mums and dads, what do you do when your toddler or child acts up in a supermarket aisle, turning what could be, you know, potentially an easy or even enjoyable Friday morning shopping trip into a very, very unpleasant one? Everyone's nerves are jangled. And we know that the summer holidays can be a real source of stress for parents. School's out, routines are changing, and we often see our little ones acting up more than usual. Some of you might try to ignore your little ones. Some of you will shout and drag them off the floor. Some will give them a hug, hope they calm down. I've tried this. So what is the right way of dealing with tears and tantrums? It's something to really have in your parenting toolkit as you prepare them for nursery and kindergarten as well, of course, ahead of September. So joining us now is Lisa Sherrington-Boyd, affectionately known as Principal Lisa. She has got decades of experience as a nanny, a special needs teacher, child and family officer, and a nursery school principal. She did hang up that principal's hat for the last time last year and set up her own private consultancy, working directly with families on everything from potty training to sleep. Lisa, how are you?
Oh, I'm very well, Helen. It's lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm not sure you're going to thank us, because over the next 45 minutes, you're going to be very busy indeed, because quite honestly, Lisa, every parent I speak to right now seems to be having a very tough time with their kids. And we know it's been nearly a year and a half of this pandemic nonsense. We as parents are feeling more stress. The heat doesn't help. I mentioned routines changing there. What are you hearing from clients?
Well, you know, the same as what you're telling me, but I'm also seeing it. So I'm out doing home visits a lot at the moment, supporting families who are struggling. And in fact, yesterday I was in Dubai Mall and I witnessed two wonderful temper tantrums from a few children. And my heart just goes out to any family that's struggling, you know, in that moment, finding it a bit difficult. Because like you say, Helen, you know, it's really hot. So just that maneuver from the car into the mall or into the supermarket is quite intense. I know myself that I feel quite kind of hot and flustered just going from the car into the supermarket. We've got all sorts of different things going on. We've got masks to negotiate. There's a lot happening for families right now.
There really is. And I think we put so much pressure on ourselves to be these kind of so-called perfect families with these little clean-faced children who will hold your hand at all times and do as you ask the first time around. And yeah, that doesn't happen very often. You know, we as adults have a massive to-do list, but we also want to make sure our kids are happy and entertained. And sometimes these things just cannot happen in parallel. So we are talking tantrums this afternoon, Lisa, and people can get in touch on 4001. Got a number of messages to get through across it. All sorts of different themes actually emerging, which is just goes to show how universal tantrums are. But you, as an educational professional, how do you define a tantrum? Can you paint us a bit of a picture about what would happen during a typical one?
Well, I mean, I've worked with children of all ages for 30 years, and we think of temper tantrums as something that really only happens to very small children. And of course that is true, but actually those really big, strong emotions can happen for all children. In fact, we know that the frontal lobe, that part of our brain which manages emotional regulation, actually doesn't fully develop until we're in our mid-20s. So it's still possible that lots of children are finding it difficult to emotionally regulate. So a temper tantrum could look like an expression of frustration, throwing things, biting, kicking, screaming, shouting, demanding, even just saying those words. You might even find your heart starts to race a bit faster, just imagining being in that moment where this awful scene is coming and you're feeling this tremendous pressure on yourself as a parent to be able to look like you've got it all under control.
Mm-hmm. And even if you don't care about how it looks to the outside world, what it can feel like as a parent in that moment is that you've lost control and you're not doing a good job. And then you start to feel your own emotions going out of control, which can then exacerbate the situation.
Yes, but you know, I wonder if it's a reality that parents are judging other parents, or that we society is judging parents on their skills in their moment. In that moment, it's very, very difficult to be able to navigate a situation that you could probably handle a little easier if you were in your own front room. Mm-hmm. But there you are, you're in the middle of the mall, you're in the middle of the supermarket, and your child has lost control, can't cope with their emotions in that moment. It's got the biggest feelings they've ever had over the fact that you put the wrong thing in the trolley just in that moment. It's difficult to deal with that situation. It's easier when you're at home and you've got that, you've got the resources around you, but it is tricky in the supermarket or the mall for sure.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
There is arguably not much more things unpleasant than witnessing a toddler's temper tantrum, except perhaps being the parent desperately trying to calm their child. But what is happening in that little one's head? What causes tantrums? And ultimately, what can we do to, if not prevent them, then certainly manage them and our own feelings in that moment? Joining us live now is Lisa Sherrington-Boyd, affectionately known as Principal Lisa. Now, Lisa, as I said, many messages coming in, which just goes to show that even the parents that, you know, we think have it together, probably bringing up children. One from Lana that we touched on earlier, and I think a lot of people are keen to get your take on this, saying, I've got a two-year-old boy at home. We put him in time out, but it's tricky when we're in a public place. If he's tantruming, should I try to ignore him? The more attention I give him, the louder he screams. So can you explain a little bit about what is happening in the brain? It's a two-year-old boy she's talking about here. And, you know, what can you do in that moment when you are out and about?
Okay, there is so much I want to say to this mummy right now, but the first thing I want to say is that after 30 years of working with children and families, there isn't really much that I haven't seen. And what I do know to be true is that all families are doing the best that they can with the skills that they have at that time. And one of the things that I really like to do is to give a family a new set of skills. So hopefully during this next hour with you, I'm going to give lots and lots of tips and advice that families can use. Now, a two-year-old has got an awful lot going on. We need to look at his little world, really, and picture it. So we've got a little person who has big, strong emotions. In fact, they often will have one emotion very intensely at one point, because we know that the part of the brain which regulates emotions is the frontal lobe, and that's really, really underdeveloped. They also don't have the language to be able to negotiate, to explain what's happening for them. They've got all of this energy which just wants to move all the time in their sort of slightly uncoordinated little bodies, and they can't cope if they get overtired or they're hungry. So the first word is halt. Hungry, angry, lonely, tired. So if you see that, you know, your child is beginning to get a bit frustrated, you're out and about, and you're thinking to yourself, I think we might have a tantrum in a minute. Check in. Have we got a hungry person? You know, do they need a little snack? Are they thirsty? Are they feeling a bit lonely? Have we been very busy in the mall today or in the supermarket? Is it very close to their sleep time? You know, what is happening for them in that moment? And what I can say is that there you are in the middle of, you know, of the supermarket might not be your best time to fix this, and to not just to see that moment in isolation, but to see it in the fullness of the day. Perhaps you might need to change your routine. Perhaps you might need to change your approach to the supermarket. Now, a two-year-old might not have the language capacity to be able to look back at what happened in the supermarket, see that perhaps it wasn't their best moment, and that some of their behaviour could be adjusted the next time that we go. Now, mummy's spoken about timeout. I'm actually not a big fan of timeout, although I understand very much so why families do it, because it gives them a chance to step out of that reptilian part of our brains as parents, which is in fight or flight, give us a moment to calm things down. However, if you are finding that you are using timeout as a behavior method more and more, then it's time to make a shift, and perhaps shift more to time in. Because when you use time in, your child will have more skills that they can use when you are out and about, because they'll be able to reflect on their behavior, find different options and problem solve with you, rather than the time out, which often leaves children maybe not feeling that they're very good at situations, so a little bit disempowered. But we can talk a bit more about that as the show goes on.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Even the chillest of parents are tested during tantrums and meltdowns. We know it's important to stay calm, but it's often the most difficult and seemingly unnatural thing to do. So what can you do in the moment? Joining us live now is Lisa Sherrington-Boyd, affectionately known as Principal Lisa. She's got decades of experience and is now offering consultations in everything from potty training to sleep and, yes, behaviour too. And Lisa, people getting in touch, of course, on 4001. We had a message earlier, no name on it. And as I mentioned, it's absolutely fine to leave your name off. We know sometimes it can feel a bit revealing and personal and private to talk about parenting and struggles you might be having. So I obviously don't mind. Just say no name. It's fine. I just want to make sure you get the answers that you need. No name on this one, saying, how do I deal with my very stubborn three-year-old who will not listen and just will not give up on things? She's also started hitting, scratching and throwing. She won't react to anything I do. I ignore, I shout, I put her on the naughty step. Nothing works. I'm at the end of my tether and she often leaves me in tears. I think something a lot of parents will identify with there, Lisa. So what would you suggest to a three-year-old little girl?
This is a very, very familiar story for me. In fact, it's something that I've been working with families for years. There are some times when actually things just reach a crisis point and what parents are doing isn't working. Because what happens is, you see, we have these gorgeous little babies and we focus in on getting them to sleep through the night, weaning them, helping them to walk. And before we know it, we realize we've actually got little people on our hands. And we might not have a behavior policy or a family set of rules all ready to go, or we might not have worked on what is actually going to be our parenting approach. And then we find ourselves in the thick of it, having to cope with these kind of behavior, and we've run out of things to say and do in the situation. It sounds to me like for this mummy, it's time to take a stop here, have a rethink, and maybe look at a different parenting approach, because what mummy is describing there just isn't working. It's interesting that she says, my child just doesn't listen and they're very stubborn, and I hear that probably once a day. What I can say is that children are like little rabbits. They've got small bodies and they've got big ears. And what I mean by that is little rabbits have big ears. They can hear everything. They pick up on what's happening around them, what adults are saying. And when we continually say to a child, you're not listening, why aren't you listening to me? You're not listening to me again. It actually traps you and your child into a vicious cycle of the child being less likely to listen. And I know this to be the case, not just through my private work of working with families, but also as a teacher. When you sit in front of a class of children and you've got 30 wiggly bottoms in front of you and you keep saying, boys and girls, you're not listening to me. Why aren't you sitting nicely? The more I do that, these children aren't going to listen to me. So I use a technique that mummy could use, which is called behavior narration, which is where you narrate the behavior that you want to see and you act as if. So today can be a new fresh start for this mummy, and just one small technique would be to cut out any language that traps the child in that particular behavior, which is obviously very tricky at the moment. We've got biting and hitting, and these things aren't okay and they do need to be addressed. But right now, let's help this child to be the best person, the best version of herself that she can be, by believing in her. Children rise and fall with our expectations of them. So let's start again. Thank you ever so much for listening to me today. I can really see that you're listening well. Wow, you really listened to me then. So you're talking using specific praise to bring about the behavior that you want to see. Now, she might not be listening to you yet, but the more you talk about her listening, the more she will listen.
Oh, the listening. Yes, we have we took the kids for eye tests recently, and I was like, I think it's more the ears that are problematic rather than the eyes. But that, thank you for that. I think it is really important to have as many things as possible in the parental toolkit, because I think a lot of us, and myself included, I'm very, very quick to react to situations rather than respond to them. And my husband too. And I know sometimes our feelings, our emotions just escalate situations, and it just seems to kind of light a fire under the whole atmosphere rather than being a cooling and calming influence. You mentioned before how timeout can often be a bit problematic for children, but I understand why parents might need that time to gather their own thoughts. You talked about a positive time in. Can you explain a little bit more about that, Lisa?
Yes, so I understand that parents need that moment, because what you've just described there is that we, as the adult in the situation, will jump into that reptilian part of our brain is, oh, this is an emergency. They're crying, they're shouting, they're biting. I'm not doing very well as a parent. Oh, oh, oh. And we're overwhelmed. And by taking a moment and a step out of the situation, we can actually go into our logical thinking part of our brain, the cortex, and maybe respond in a different way. So we need a moment to make the shift. So yes, time out can give it to us. However, the premise of time out works on this factor, that the child will dislike it, they don't want to do it, therefore they will adjust their behavior and not do the behavior again. So if I punish my child or I make them take time out from that situation, they won't do the behavior again. However, more and more research is coming through that children will spend that time out actually doubting themselves, mm-hmm. doubting that their parents love them, thinking maybe that their parents love their sibling more, feeling confused, unable to even feel anything because they're also in that reptilian part of their brain, so they're full of anger. And by being separate, we disconnected. And we know that children do better when they feel better. And we know ourselves as adults that if we think we're good at something, we actually do better at it. And so what we want to do is to give ourselves a bit of a chance to, you know, de-escalate the situation and process what's happening, but also give our child some of the skills that they might need should this situation again happen again. So what do? We need to give them a few opt-outs. It sounds like you're telling me that you feel really frustrated right now. I can hear you. I understand it feels frustrating not to be able to do this or do that. And I'm wondering if you might like some cozy time, just a chance to have a little get cozy. Would you like me to join you for that cozy time, or would you like to have your cozy time on your own? You could say something like, it sounds like you're feeling really furious and really angry today. would you like to take a walk around the garden with me? Or we can sit on the sofa and do some of our square breathing that we've practiced while we just start to calm down. All we want from that moment is just to de-escalate. We're not fixing it. We're not asking them to adjust their behavior. We're not using any kind of justice or consequence or punishment system. We're just de-escalating. So rather than time out where we disconnect from the child, we have time out where we're staying with the child, taking a moment to have a breather, giving them back some power, some autonomy. And then later on, we could address the behavior that perhaps was the challenging part. Maybe they hit or bit or did something wrong. So we come back to that behavior when they're not full of these really big emotions that they can't process.
I think that is really, really important. When you start to look at, as you mentioned before, the development of the brain at that age, to try and teach a lesson during a tantrum, try and apply any kind of logic or reasoning, you are onto an absolute loser, because that child's brain is just not available during a tantrum for learning. It's basically shut down. It's not a time to be teaching moments. It's a time to, as you say, de-escalate. And then you can come back to that when things are a bit calmer. It is your last chance to get in touch with Lisa Sherrington-Boyd, aka Principal Lisa. If you do have any questions regarding your child, any tantrums that are happening in your house, maybe you just want to have a bit of vent or even share what's been working for you. My parenting technique up until recently has been empty threats and bribery. Let's just say it hasn't been working very well.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Lisa Sherrington-Boyd with us this afternoon, aka Principal Lisa. She's offering at-home consultancies on everything from potty training to sleep and, yes, behaviour too. Nadia's been in touch saying, love you both. Thanks, Nadia. Nadia's got 22-month-old twins, so I think that's officially known as being in the trenches. She says, my son loves routine, doesn't like to change things, but my daughter is becoming a bit of a rebel and takes longer to do things like bath, eat or sleep. She started screaming or pushing her brother, and we try to stay calm and talk to her, but it's taking sometimes an hour to get things done as we accommodate what she wants, and her brother patiently waits. Please help. The juggle and the struggle is real, it sounds like, Lisa. What would you suggest in this situation? Because I think there can be this balance between wanting our children to be heard and be validated, and sometimes you just need to leave the house and crack on with things.
Yes, and I hear Nadia. Thank you so much for getting in touch, Nadia. I follow Nadia on Instagram. She's doing a great job. So the thing is, in that situation, we've got somebody who's trying to gain a bit of power and a bit of control in this situation, who also might be finding it difficult to regulate her emotions. I certainly wouldn't be waiting an hour to get little one to follow through with a task that's expected and what needs to happen. So I wouldn't necessarily focus in on that moment too much, but I would work on other skills outside of that, where she does have other opportunities to assert some power. So working on lots and lots of Montessori life skills with her. So getting her to feel empowered that she's really great at doing things for herself in other areas, such as she can fold towels. She can help to peel an orange. Get in touch with me, Nadia, and I'll give you a list of Montessori type tasks for toddlers to give them empowerment. But in the moment, I find a two choice frame works really well for toddlers. I understand that you would rather be playing with your toys right now, but it is bath time. So would you like to take your mermaids in the bath with you today? Or would you like to take your floating duck set? You choose. So she's still going to get into the bath, but you've given her a two choice so that she feels empowered.
Love it.
If she doesn't take those choices, you could redirect a moment, do something else, and then offer back with the choice. If she still doesn't make the choice, then that's when you say, gosh, it seems like maybe you've chosen to take your mermaids. Let's pick them up and let's go, and then follow through with that. And then she understands that when you offer her the two choices, you are going to follow it through, and you've given her a little bit of power at the same time.
And the crucial thing is, as a parent, you don't really care which of the two choices she chooses. You're happy with the fact she's just doing anything. Lisa, we've run out of time. We haven't run out of questions. So I think we need to revisit this topic, certainly over the summer when our parental nerves have just about had enough with the lack of routine. So thank you so much for your insights as ever. Lisa Sherrington-Boyd can be found on Instagram as Principal Lisa. So if you do need any expert tips and advice, we are here for you on Dubai Eye, and she is there on line two.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
There are inevitably, even with the best of intentions, objects around your home that could be dangerous to your kids. Around a month ago, a two-year-old girl died in England after swallowing a button battery from a remote control. Inquest found acid from the battery burned through her food pipe into a major artery. Her mother said she didn't realise the dangers and wants to raise awareness with other parents. So as well as remote controls, button batteries are found in a huge range of products, watches, toys, kitchen scales and more. Joining us now, Rebecca Smith from Safe Hands. Rebecca, it's really tragic, to be honest, that it comes to a story like this to have us often talking about it. I know this is something you, as MD of Safe Hands, are very much aware of, but for the rest of us, we're somewhat willfully ignorant about some of the household dangers. You know, and unfortunately, over the course of the last year, people being told to stay at home, keep our kids at home, and unfortunately, that has led to more at-home instances. Many parents might not know there are some seemingly harmless objects around our homes that are a real hazard to our children. Have you seen anything similar happen here or even any close calls?
Firstly, a pleasure to be speaking to you again, Helen, not so great circumstances again. I know we had a conversation after the back of the football incident recently, mm-hmm. talking about CPR, and this is just another one of those situations where something really tragic has prompted quite an important conversation. But you're entirely right in what you're saying there in terms of lockdown, you know, children spending more time at home. We have seen a spike in household injuries, and included in that category, are ingestion and choking incidents. Little ones, particularly really little ones, younger children have a tendency to put anything and everything in their mouths. And whether that object is swallowed or, travels into the airway to cause a choking incident, either instance isn't great, and we need to know how to deal with that. We do hear of choking incidents happening quite frequently, and the main sort of objects that we hear of choking occurring from are food objects, food items, things like your grapes, your whole peanuts, big chunks of meat or cheese, bread being a common one that we hear about as well. But when it comes to ingested objects, coins are quite a common one we hear about. I think it's the most common I hear about in my line of work. Other ones include things like fish bones, small toy parts, paper clips, earrings, buttons, and the most dangerous ones being the sharp ones like your paper clips, as mentioned, pins, tacks, needles, and also your hazardous substances like the one we heard about in this article, which was a battery, mm-hmm. and also magnets are quite dangerous as well.
Yeah, there's been an awful lot around magnets actually, because of some of them being viewed as toys and used in viral videos, and we know kids are like little magpies. Some of the items you mentioned there, you know, metal, super shiny, the little hand goes out and it becomes this reflex. We see it happen all the time, and I did with my little ones when they were really small. The mouth, you know, it's just open, it's like a little guppy, and the hand just goes up there. And unfortunately, as you say, some of the items that are really commonly ingested are really, really dangerous. Can you explain what happens during choking and when it is an emergency, Rebecca?
Yeah, sure. So choking occurs when an object or a food item actually travels into the airway as opposed to the esophagus, which is the pipe located just behind the airway where food and drink usually goes down, usually travels down to the stomach. Really common in little ones because of their, you know, ability to swallow and the fact that they put large things in their mouth and they have a small mouth in comparison to what usually goes in there as well. So firstly, a choking incident occurs because, like I say, an object gets lodged in the airway as opposed to the esophagus. Sometimes that can be cleared on its own, and sometimes it causes what we call a mild blockage. What you might see from a mild blockage would be a child instantly starting to cough, maybe going red in the face, a little bit of drama around the situation naturally. And I know coughing and crying in any other usual situation involving your little one isn't usually a nice sound to hear, but in this sort of situation, it is the best sound, like music to your ears. If the child can still cough or talk to you in some way, it means that the airway isn't fully blocked. And what we want to do in that instance is just pat them on the back, encourage coughing, and more likely, most likely, that will clear itself. When we do have to worry is when we've got a severe blockage of the airway, which means it's fully covered, and the child will be unable to breathe because of that. Signs and symptoms that it's a severe blockage would be no sound at all, okay? So if the child's eating or you see them put something in their mouth, you might have that sound initially in terms of a mild blockage situation, but then that will stop. You usually have a fixed stare, a flushed appearance in their cheek initially, maybe some tearing of their eyes, and that lack of sound, and maybe them pointing to their throat, holding their throat, would be an indication that it's a very severe situation. We need to act fast.
So what would we do, as you say, if those red flags have been raised, Rebecca? And we know that in the moment there's panic, we get into often freeze mode, which is why first aid training is so important, and to know it and to practice it, because... Yeah. That when that adrenaline starts pumping. So when you've identified that it is a severe choking incident, what is the first thing that you as a parent or a bystander even should do?
So the skills that you use depend on the age range of the child. If we were talking about an infant, which from a first aid perspective is anyone below the age of one, what we'd want to do is immediately pick the child up, take them out of the high chair or pick them up, and we want to turn them away from us and then position them down the thigh, okay? So down our thigh, with us being in a knelt position to allow them to be positioned down our thigh, or seated on a chair. Make sure the head is positioned on the end of your knee, and make sure they're in a slightly tilted position with the head towards the floor. Imagine you want to use gravity to try and help you get the object out as well. Once in the tilted position, you want to administer 5 hard, sharp back slaps with the heel of your hand directly in between the infant's shoulder blades. After doing that, you want to tilt them onto their side, do a quick check in the mouth to see if the object's there. And if you've done those in the right place with the right amount of force, hopefully that would be the case. If not, though, if you still don't have that sound and you still can't see the object, we would then roll the child onto their back, still keeping them in that tilted position with the head towards the floor, and administer 5 chest thrusts, okay, which is when you place 2 fingers on the sternum, right in between the rib cage in the center of their chest, and you push down to a depth of about 1.5 inches 5 times. You then continue that until the object's dislodged in terms of those 5 back slaps, 5 chest thrusts, or until the child becomes unconscious, at which point we'd have to look at more sort of serious skills like CPR. If you've got an older child or an adult, we'd focus on a technique called the Heimlich maneuver. For anyone that's seen the film Mrs. Doubtfire, it was a key scene in that movie. Okay, and it's when you position yourself behind a choking person and you use abdominal thrust to try and clear a blockage in the airway. Mm-hmm. The main sort of guidelines for getting the right place is that you want to place your fist in between the person's navel or the belly button and the start of the sternum, okay? So between the rib cage. That space between the belly button and the space where the rib cage meet, that's where you want to place your fist. And you want to grab that fist with the other hand, reaching around the person and pull inwards and upwards, okay? If you have a child between 1 and 5, we do recommend trying 5 back slaps first, then moving on to the Heimlich. In anyone 5 years or above, you can start with the Heimlich maneuver straight away and continue with those abdominal thrusts again until that object is removed or the person loses consciousness. Quite scary situation. Quite scary techniques to have to use, but they are very, very effective. I will say this about these first aid skills. They are super effective. It's just a case of knowing them and knowing what to do.
And of course, prevention always better. So in your words, you know, think like a child, look at the risks in every room. And of course, don't forget 998 if it is an emergency. Rebecca, thank you so, so much for joining us from Safe Hands. Always a lot to discuss and always a lot to learn. So I know you've seen a real spike in people signing up themselves and their helpers for your training courses. So thank you. Keep up the great work.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Great to have you with us. It is your free clinic. No need to make an appointment. Just need to pick up your phone. Delighted to be joined by Dr. Rania, paediatrician at Circle Care Clinic. We've been talking about choking and several of you getting in touch on that. But really, anything that's on your mind when it comes to your child's health, we are here for you. Dr. Rania, as we said, about a month ago, a 2-year-old little girl died in England after swallowing a button battery. It was from a remote control in her home. And speaking there to Rebecca from Safe Hands, and she said she's seen a number of close calls. And it's something parents really fear, that choking, whether it is on a household object or when you move on to going on to solid food. Why do kids put stuff in their mouths? What is this about? Is it just to test our nerves?
Very good question. Hi, Helen. How are you?
I'm good.
The mouth is children's primary source of exploration. So you find that children from the age of 3 months old start putting their hands in their mouth and then start exploring textures and temperatures, what have you. And they don't stop doing it until they're well into their, if you're lucky, 5 or 6 years old. I know my 5-year-old still puts his hand in his mouth. So it is an issue. And button batteries specifically cause a danger that no parent wants to ever face. Lucky for us, and I'm sure Rebecca would have mentioned this, is as we said, close calls. I haven't heard of a case where we've had a fatality like that unfortunate case in the UK. But they are extremely dangerous. And I, for one, scrounge and go through any of the toys my children have and try and make sure there aren't any that contain button batteries. And if there are, make sure there are the spare button batteries for garage remote controls and what have you that use them are kept well away from the children.
What is in a battery that causes so much harm? What happens in the body if they are ingested?
So the button battery itself, the difference between that and a regular longer shaped battery is the positive and negative poles of the battery are very close to each other. So it's very easy to create a charge. Once swallowed, the fluid within our body, which is essentially the base of it, is saline. It's salts dissolved in water. Once that can create a charge, so the battery itself causes an electric charge in that water, breaks down the water molecules, and it's the byproduct of that, it's the hydroxide molecules themselves that burn through our intestines, and then if we're unlucky, blood vessels, which is what happened with that child. It's not actually the acid within the battery. There's very little acid in a button battery. It's its ability to create a charge, and that's the danger.
Oh, it gives me chills. It really, really does.
Exactly. We
are Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking children's health this afternoon with Dr. Rania, paediatrician at Circle Care Clinic. So Dr. Rania, I dropped my kids off at school this morning. We had a couple of days of distance learning last week, which sent shivers down my spine that it was going to be continuing into this week. But thankfully, they were returned 8 o'clock this morning. My goodness gracious me, it was quiet. It was eerily quiet. The crossing guard, as I was leaving the school, I was like, what's going on? He says, I don't know, it's very strange. I think there were about 5 kids in my daughter's classes. Are people heading off? Are people keeping kids at home, isolating to make sure they can travel? What's your take?
Both. So many people are traveling. And so many people are keeping their kids at home to try and avoid them being primary contact, them having to isolate, maybe not so much being scared of them catching COVID during this time, but more to avoid the unnecessary isolation and the disruption of travel plans. So yes, I can relate, except in my case, my five-year-old had a runny nose and a bit of a fever this morning.
Oh, no.
So I had to stay home. And because I have to practice what I preach, I did a PCR test and I just got the results, which is negative, thankfully. Okay. He's negative, thankfully. So hopefully back to school for his last end of year party on Tuesday if he's fever free tomorrow. We'll see. But the point is, there are so many more viruses than there have been in the last 18 months. We are so busy at the clinic, and regular viruses, the viruses we've missed, we've forgotten about, the viruses we would normally see during the winter months have come back with a vengeance. We're seeing this in lots of countries, lots of articles coming out from the UK or the US talking about viruses like RSV, like hand, foot and mouth, like all these stomach viruses. And I think it's people are being slightly more relaxed with the adults vaccinated, people are feeling a little bit safer. But also over here, it's hot and everyone's gone indoors. It's the play areas and the lots of more indoor gatherings and sort of time spent with each other that's causing the transmission of these viruses. And I think our children's immune systems took a pause, you know, if you can say that, over the last 18 months, and are now suffering. So we're seeing a lot in that regards as well.
Well, exactly that message from Asala saying, my four-year-old daughter has the sniffles. We've got a flight in 2 days. Does she need to get tested? Seems silly to postpone our flights over a cold. Thank you.
Yes, so the likelihood is that this is just a cold, but the beauty of getting tested and getting that negative, you will feel the way I feel today, which is that I know this is just a cold. I don't have to worry, because the truth is nobody can clinically tell you whether it is or isn't COVID. So if I would say that, considering the her travel plans, yes, it's just easier to get that test, get it out of the way without having to wonder or worry, especially about the loved ones at the other end, if that's what they're doing.
Absolutely. Okay, really hope it. I'm staying positive, hoping you test negative. Just everyone out there who's got plans. Now, as I said to Noni earlier, I'm booked in tomorrow morning for my Pfizer booster, and you looked very happy at this. And I think a lot of people are on kind of a similar cycle to me. Got vaccinated back in January, and are now looking at that 6 month mark. What about you? What's your move?
So yeah, I'm in this special group where we don't know, because I got Pfizer very early on. I got my first dose on the 23rd of December and wow. Second on 19th of January. So I'm coming up to wondering what happens to us Pfizer people. When do we get our boosters? I don't know. I did manage to get my antibodies tested a while ago, and they were at a decent level, so I'm not too worried. But I think everyone will need boosters. And the way I'm explaining it to people is, like newborns get their vaccine at 2, 4, and 6 months, and then those same vaccines stretch out and then are boosted again at 18 months and then at 4 years. For us, our bodies don't know COVID. Our bodies are virgins when it comes to COVID, for lack of a better word. So it will take a few years of vaccinations to get that safe zone in between doses, and then we could start getting them annually. So it makes absolute sense to need a vaccine booster at 6 months now, and perhaps at 9 months the next time, and maybe a bit longer after that. So I think this is all to be expected. Sinopharm is a fantastic vaccine. Without it, I don't think the UAE would have done what it was able to do in terms of being more open, compared to other countries, neighboring countries even. And I think now that we have all this choice, and now with Moderna coming in as well, it's we're very lucky. And the idea of boosting with an mRNA vaccine makes sense, because all the studies coming out show that you get a fantastic immune response when you do that, especially in the run-up to holidays.
That's my plan. I'm going to have a nice heavy arm on the buttons tomorrow afternoon, no doubt.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Joining us live on the line is Dr. Rania, paediatrician at Circle Care Clinic. Great to have you with us, and many people getting in touch with questions. We're going to squeeze in as many as as many as we can. Question here from Alana saying, my one-year-old has got small red marks on each cheek for several months now. They look a bit like blemishes, but don't seem to be disappearing. They aren't causing her any discomfort, but I've tried Sudocrem, good old Sudocrem, and moisturiser, but not excessively. See, back it was always germaline when I was growing up. My mum would always have like a tube of germaline that would just get brought out at every occasion. It was basically have a hot bath, put some germaline on, and everything will be fine. Sudocrem here for Alana's one-year-old. Small red marks on each cheek. What comes to mind there?
It depends how they feel. So if they are dry to touch, they may be eczematous. It's not surprising considering the weather changes and whether at her age she's teething. So I think thick moisturizers would work best then. And if not, I think bring her in to either see a pediatrician or a dermatologist and we can help.
Okay, hope that helps. Now, we were just talking vaccines, and we know that there are trials going on now for the younger age group, teens now able. But a bit of a philosophical question, parental question about consent, really. What's your take, Dr. Rania, when it comes to asking our children if they want the vaccine or insisting as parents? What's your take?
It's a principle of competence. So I think it's, and this is scientific, not so much philosophical. I think when I trained, one of the things we learned about is a child's competence to refuse a type of treatment was perhaps set at a lower age. So they had the competence to refuse treatment younger than they had the competence to accept. And we used to talk about this when it came to contraception and teenagers and things like that. But when it comes to vaccinations, I think specifically with this one, it's a very interesting topic. I don't think any younger than 16 is an age where they can have the capacity fully to understand the ramifications of vaccinating or not vaccinating, specifically when it comes to these vaccines where we ourselves as adults for ourselves vaccines without the reams of data that other vaccinations have find it difficult making that decision. I think it's very important we involve children when it comes to their vaccines. When it comes to the 12-year-olds plus and their ability to get Pfizer now, I have not seen as many kids run towards a needle in my life. A lot of them want it. I want it because of the safety it brings. I want it because of the what they believe normality it will bring back. So I think if parents are on board with a vaccination, it makes sense to discuss this with children, especially one that is not a mandatory vaccine. So the COVID vaccines being one of them. But if a child refuses, but the parents know the child to have risk factors that could put the child or those around the child at risk, then it is the parent's prerogative to go for it. But I would not physically force a vaccine. When it comes to the toddlers who don't know what's good for them and are scared of a needle, rightly so, again, preparing them is good, but at the end of the day, what's good for them is this vaccination. Until we come up with better ways of administering these vaccines that don't involve needles, unfortunately, at some time, you know, the majority of cases, you would have to just go for it.
Thank you, Dr. Rania. I think always worth, I mean, you can only go by your own thoughts, and that's the case of all vaccinations, of course, and we know that it's still very much an ongoing research when it comes to COVID as well. So I really hope that help anyone and make an informed decision on that. We've been talking about choking this hour, Dr. Rania, in a message here, not necessarily on an object, but Laurel's worried about her 10-week-old baby having trouble with choking on her vomit. It's happened about 5 times since bringing her home. She feeds and burps after feeding, brings up a little bit of milk. When the choking happens, it's usually 2 or 3 hours after feeding. She'll be lying and vomit is getting stuck. She can't move the blockage herself. We've got to flip her over and pat her on the back hard to clear it. Today, she's gone quite pale. Just wondering if there's anything I can do to help her. Doctor said I need to make sure she's being winded properly, but I'm now terrified of leaving her in case it happens again. And it is. I mean, it sounds really scary, especially she's saying she's going there quite a pale colour. What would you say, Dr. Rania? Is this worth going back to the doctors?
Yeah, it sounds like she may have some reflux. And one of the things you manage this best with at the beginning is positioning the baby whereby the head of the baby is above the level of the stomach, at least at a 30-degree angle, even during sleep. During daytime naps, when the baby's being observed during their naps, then it's also safe to put her on her left side, which should reduce these episodes. And if they're still happening, she should see her pediatrician, because there are other things we can do to help. This almost always settles on its own, but positioning is the best. So when feeding, feeding, holding her upright after feeds, and tilting or putting something under the mattress like a wedge to tilt it to that level.
Really hope that helps, Laurel. All the very best to you and your little one. And all the best to you as well, Dr. Rania. You can be found at Circle Care Clinic. Lots of messages today. We'd love to have you back. And in the meantime, people can find you on Instagram for some no-nonsense advice and your take on what's happening in the headlines. What's the best place to follow you online?
So it's Dr. Rania DXB. And yeah, I'd be happy to answer anyone's questions if they send them there.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Rania. Really do appreciate it. And I hope everyone out there is feeling all right today. As we said, lots of sniffles, lots of viruses going around. But please, 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 if you are worried, do get tested.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is Sunday and we're talking education, and a timely topic: is your child anxiously awaiting the results of their IB exam? Because tomorrow, Monday the 5th of July, is International Baccalaureate Results Day, which will impact many students across the UAE. It's also the day that the UCAS clearing system opens for any UK university entrants. So for those who didn't meet their predicted grades, can get their offer looked at and perhaps look at some alternative courses as well. To explain a little bit more, Fiona McKenzie joining us, the head of education at Carfax Education. And Fiona, I mean, do you remember your results day? What was it like?
Oh gosh, it was so terrifying. And you know, with hindsight, I wasn't even in the country when my results came through. And it was, in those days, it's a long time ago, it was all via post. So I got back home after a lovely holiday and there was that envelope waiting on the doorstep. Really scary. But I think, you know, nowadays things are much faster and much slicker and obviously all done online. And
Is that worse? I don't know. I had to go and pick up a very ominous looking brown A4 envelope from my school. And of course, you walk past groups of other students, some are crying, some are jumping up and down. You're going to go, which camp am I in? Which camp am I in? And my parents were on holiday, and to this day, and the, I mean, I finished high school in 2000. So yeah, we're, you know, 20 plus years. My mum still to this day doesn't forgive herself for not being there on my results day. And then there was always like this big night out plan to, you know, celebrate or commiserate. And I promptly got tonsillitis, I think, just out of pure stress. So I don't know, is it worse to sit in a car or on the steps of your school with an envelope, or is it there with your parents clicking a mouse? Oh, but I am thinking of everyone today.
It is agony. And I think, you know, and this year has been such a bumpy and turbulent year for these students that you know, they've really ridden the roller coaster. I think they're probably just quite relieved to get to the end and get the results and hopefully be able to move on with their education journey.
I really hope so, because as you refer to there, we've had ups and downs, we've had cancellations, we've had graduations at school being cancelled and then confirmed, and, you know, some people missing the deadline for that. It's been a really, really tough year. I mean, my goodness, being a teenager is tricky enough, never mind through a pandemic, and how well education systems have had to adjust and adapt and communicate. It's so, kudos to any teachers out there. My goodness, you've been working your socks off.
I agree. Yeah, great shout out to the teachers. And I think particularly because of the last minute change for IB, when the kids were all thinking they were going to sit their exams up until really quite close to the deadline. And then there was a sudden switch to know it's all going to actually be teacher assessed or school assessed grades. And so the teachers then had to turn around and really pull it out of the bag. And they have done hundreds of hours of work assessing and collating kind of results and data and putting forward, you know, portfolios of evidence for all of their students. So yeah, I agree with you. Big shout out for the teachers.
So as you say, you know, the exams looked like they were happening, and then close to the deadline, it was agreed the results were going to be based on teacher assessed grades rather than those exams. Would you have any inkling of what impact that might have when it comes to results tomorrow?
Well, I think it's really interesting. I mean, talking to both teachers and to students. I mean, I think luckily, because last year a similar thing happened, schools have had a lot more kind of, they put many more systems in place this year. So I think, you know, that they've been collecting data all throughout the year. And certainly all the students that we have been working with, we've said, don't let your grades slip. You have to keep a really steady level all year. You cannot leave it all to the last minute just in case they cancel exams again. And, you know, how fortuitous is that? Because, you know, the kids have had to keep their foot on the pedal all year. And that's been tough because sometimes it's been, you know, they've been doing it online, sometimes they've been in school. So it's been a very pressurized year, I think, for these students, because they've just not known quite how this whole thing was going to play out. But play out it did, and teacher assessed grades is where we are. And I think tomorrow, I mean, it'll be really interesting to see. I think schools have put in place systems for subject assessments and gathering evidence and data. And obviously for IB, they have the internal assessments as well. So there's lots of evidence that the schools can present to back up their kind of predictions for the students. But I think one of the challenges is that the IB organisations actually pegged schools so that they have to keep their results in line with the last three, you know, average of their grades of the last 3 years. So that means in some cases they can only allocate a certain number of grades per subject. So even though they've done all of this work and they've submitted it all to the boards, we're still not quite sure how it's going to play out tomorrow.
So let's then explain a little bit about what I mentioned earlier. If students based here in the UAE have got their sights set on a UK university, tomorrow the IB results come out, tomorrow the clearing system is open for business. For anyone who's not familiar with that UCAS clearing system, what is it all about, Fiona? How does it work?
Well, just to be clear, the IB results go to schools tomorrow, then they'll be released to students on the 6th of July. So students will get their results, be able to pick up their results on the 6th of July. And for any student who's unclear about how they're meant to be doing that, I really strongly advise them to contact their school today so that they know exactly kind of what protocols they've got to go through to access their results. They'll also be able to see their results updated in the track system, in the UK university system. They have a thing called track, and that will tell you when your results have been received, whether your university office have been confirmed or not. And so keep an eye on that. And it might take the universities a couple of days to update that data, so, you know, don't panic, because obviously they're getting a lot of information in. And also students need to remember that the universities receive their IBO results directly from IB. So they shouldn't, unless they're independent candidates, they shouldn't need to confirm those results. They'll just go straight through to the university.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking education this hour. Is your child awaiting that email, the results of their International Baccalaureate? They are out tomorrow. And we know the UK clearing system are kicking into place very soon as well. So what happens if your child has got the results that they were expecting? What happens if they've perhaps not reached their predicted grades? Or what if they've even exceeded them? We're in conversation with Fiona McKenzie, Head of Education at Carfax, saying that IB students have worked so hard that they deserve to celebrate no matter what.
If you meet the conditions of your offer, happy days, please celebrate. You've had a tough year and you've secured your place and you've achieved your goal, and you can just be really, really happy. It will be such an amazing moment for those kids. But you're right, for some kids, it might not pan out as they had anticipated. And if that is the case, my first piece of advice for any student is call the university and just have a chat with them and see if there's any way they would still consider you. Because maybe you've only missed your offer very, very marginally. Maybe you're going to get some papers remarked, or you're appealing your grades, in which case you need to ask the university to kind of put your offer on hold and give you a chance to get that sorted out. And universities are generally quite understanding about that. So, you know, don't despair. If you haven't met your grades, don't despair. But if you've missed both of your offers, i.e. your firm and your insurance, then you will automatically be entered into clearing. And clearing is an amazing system. It's kind of like a giant sale, if you like. You know, all the universities put all of the places they still have left onto this massive kind of clearing system. And you can go in with your grades and check out and see what's there, see who's got what's left over, if you like. But sometimes some top universities have really, you know, places on really good courses. So it's absolutely worth looking at it. Do you know, last year, 60,000 students got places through clearing. So it's not a minor sport, do you know what I mean? It's a big part of the application process. This year, one of the new and I think quite exciting things about clearing is they've introduced a system called Clearing Plus, and this will automatically match your results and your original application to universities who have got spaces on their courses.
Wow,
so that's going to simplify things.
Very clever. Mm. So that would save you then kind of trawling the system and speaking to someone. This is like the future.
Yes.
I mean, speaking from, you know, what happened with me is that I was very, very, very single-minded about the course I wanted to get onto. I barely had any kind of backups at all. And as it happened, I got the, this is again back in the day, I got the number of points, but I didn't get the grade. So I needed 3 B's and I got 2 A's and a D. And I remember calling the head of course and going, I desperately want to come. And her going, well, 2 A's is amazing. We'll forget about the French. And, you know, we'd love to have you. But if she hadn't said that, I think I would have been in such a spin. So if people haven't got, as you say, their first choice in their insurance, what are some of the questions they can ask themselves when it comes to thinking about a different university or even a different course to help steer them in a direction that might be as fulfilling or hopefully more fulfilling than their first preference?
I think that is such a good question, Helen, because it's actually a really good time to reflect. Because for a lot of students, they will have made the decision about what they want to study and at which universities, you know, coming up for maybe almost a year ago. And then they've been sort of set on that path. And then suddenly you get your results, maybe everything's thrown up into the air, and it's a really good chance to rethink things. And certainly do not despair. That's my kind of key thing. No one is defined by their exam results. So there's plenty of opportunities and plenty of exciting things ahead. It's just a question of identifying the right ones. So I think you need to think, how committed are you to that particular course? Is it actually really going to suit you? You know, maybe your exam results have highlighted other strengths that you hadn't perhaps realised. And so it's a good opportunity to kind of rethink that. And in terms of universities, again, go into clearing, see what else is out there, and see what other universities have got opportunities. You know, maybe you were dead set on a London university, and maybe this has made you rethink and think maybe actually a kind of campus university might be more kind of up my street, might be more what I'm looking for. So it is a really, if it hasn't panned out, it is a really good opportunity to reflect. Actually, even if it has panned out, it's still a good opportunity to reflect, because you can, you know, you can still change your mind at this stage. And if you find something you prefer in clearing, you can ask to be released from your firm place and apply somewhere else. But the really key thing is to talk to all of these universities. And IB students have a real advantage because they get their results this week, whereas A-level students have to wait for another till this year, the 10th of August. So IB students have a little bit of time to do the research, to talk to universities and to work out what they want to do next before actually making a kind of firm commitment. And I just think the amount of research students do to pick their final five UK universities, you don't want to suddenly rush into something now at the last minute and be under pressure to say yes to something you're not super comfortable with. Mm-hmm. So do take time to reflect, I think.
And, you know, fingers firmly crossed, everybody gets what they want tomorrow. What if things go better than expected and you get higher grades than perhaps you'd been predicted? What is the system then? I know there's the, you know, because has their adjustment kind of suggestion. So
yeah,
presumably
exactly
you could then go on to do something that you'd initially ruled out.
Exactly. And that, again, is such an exciting opportunity. You open that envelope or you go online and see your results. You're like, wow, that's so much better than I thought I was going to get. You know, when I put in my application in last December, how fantastic. And there is an opportunity to, exactly as you described, to upgrade, if you like, to trade up. And again, so you can go into adjustment and you can see what universities are out there that have, again, still got places. And then you can call them up and have a chat with them and explain your grades and explain why you want to do that course with them. And then hopefully they will make you an offer. It's so important to talk to these universities, and it has to be the students that do that, but partly because the universities are only authorised to deal with the students, but also it's so much more meaningful if it's coming from a student. But I do always advise my students to kind of do a bit of a script and sort of think about what they want to say, because when you're feeling a bit kind of nervous and you're suddenly talking to these people, you want to make sure that you're giving your best self, because you really want to convince them to take you. So think about the things you want to say, think about how you're going to say it, maybe have a bit of a rehearsal.
Definitely practice. It gives me anxiety just thinking about it. Fiona, I wanted to ask you as well, and you know, perhaps get your crystal ball out and look ahead to September. What do you think that university experience is going to be like for first year students?
Well, I mean, this time last year, I was saying, go to university, because by January, it'll all be fine. But look what happened. I genuinely think universities are gunning to be back to normal this September. They really are. In fact, we've got various students who the universities are actually going to international students, so they're going to fund their quarantine period and the tests they have to take just to facilitate things for them. So they really are planning to be open for business. Whether that will be with COVID restrictions still in place, I mean, you know, we're looking at the 19th of July as being all bets off and everything back to normal in the UK. But I think the jury's, you know, still out by September. But the plans, as far as we can tell from all of the universities we're in touch with, is that it will be business as usual. And I think everyone's very excited about that.
I think that's exactly the right note to end it on, regardless of what results are opened up or clicked upon tomorrow. You'll get to exactly where you need to be, and there's an awful lot of support and certainly a lot of people who are ready to help you if it's not the results that you were expecting, or, fingers crossed, better than predicted. Fiona, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Fiona McKenzie, Head of Education at Carfax Education. And exciting times for tomorrow, fingers crossed, for all of your students as well.
Good luck to everybody.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune into Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.